Subversive women and Exodus. So the story of the Israelites' redemption from slavery is likely familiar to us all. Even for people who do not identify as Christians likely know at least the general story. It's part of our cultural consciousness, and of course it's honestly a great yarn. If you were born before 1959 or thereabouts, perhaps the mentioning of Exodus pictures up an image of Charlton Heston with a very glorious beard, waving around a staff and smashing the Ten Commandments. Perhaps you get visions of Christian Bale as Moses, a man who struggles with his identity as an Israelite brought up as an Egyptian and eventually must come up against his former brother, the Pharaoh, who is inexplicably played by an Australian actor, Joel Edgerton, and has an Australian accent. Perhaps the Exodus story evokes for you an animated Moses, and I must say this is true for me, with the voice of Val Kilmer from The Prince of Egypt, which had a very beautiful music score, by the way. To be a little bit more serious, the Exodus tradition is extraordinarily important. It is the greatest redemptive event in the Old Testament, to which subsequent revelation points to again and again and again. And you can see some examples up there. It sits at the beginning of the Ten Commandments, the law. It's mentioned in the Psalms. It's alluded to in the prophets, including Hosea, but also within the Isaiah scroll, which you see quoted by Jesus in Luke. The Isaiah scroll is clearly referring to the experience of the captives being released from exile, but it also draws on the language of the Exodus tradition. The delivery from enslavement to Pharaoh is both a physical salvation, but of course it is also something more. Rather than slaving for Pharaoh with this Hebrew word avad, the Hebrews must be freed so that they may serve or worship God. And this is the same root word in Hebrew, avad. So within this context, the Hebrews and the Israelites, the Hebrews, they're also called the Israelites, they have to be released from slavery so they can enter into a special covenant or treaty with God. This is a really intimate relationship. It binds the Israelites and God together. And we see this in Exodus 19 to 24. Of course, for Jews, the Exodus tradition forms the basis of the Passover, the Pesach, one of the most important Jewish holidays. For Christians, the story of redemption from slavery becomes a forerunner for the redeeming work of Christ, as we saw alluded to in the Luke reading. Now, everyday folk and theologians have looked to the Exodus story, and from it they've discerned their own God-given dignity, their worth, their right to freedom, and they have also found a model for their own struggle towards liberation from degrading and inhumane circumstances. Exodus was important for the abolitionist movement in England, in the US and the Caribbean. That is, it was part of the fight to abolish the transatlantic slave trade. It formed the imagination of the famous Baptist minister, Martin Luther King Jr., and the civil rights movement. Since the 1960s, it has been invoked by people living in poverty who are fighting for social justice and economic equality in Latin America. In other words, it's a little bit of a big deal, the Exodus tradition. Yet, you might be forgiven for thinking that Exodus is a narrative about men and that the act of redeeming or saving is in some way gendered, that it is in some way masculine. In Exodus 15, in the song that describes the crossing of the Red Sea, Yahweh, the Israelite God who redeems, is depicted as a great warrior who triumphs, who conquests over enemies in battle. Moses, the one to whom God reveals himself, is also a man. He is tasked with the job of representing God in confronting the most powerful man of the ancient world, the Pharaoh. And he's tasked with bringing the entire Hebrew people out of Egypt, out of slavery. Of course, Moses' brother is a priest, and he's given the task of being Moses' spokesperson. But this is not the full picture. This is not the only part of the story we can focus on. If we take a closer or deeper look at the text, it reveals that women are truly heroes of the story. Women predominate in Exodus 1 to 2, and it's their courage, it's their acts of civil disobedience and love that secure the Israelites' survival, and so they bring the nation's redemption. In fact, there are 12 important women in the opening chapters of Exodus. And it's these women, it's their subversive behaviour that will ultimately lead to the freedom of the 12 tribes of Israel. Right, so who are these women? Well, we've heard some of the text. We've got Shifra and Puah, the Hebrew midwives. We have a Levite woman, the mother of Moses, who is later called Jochebed in Exodus 6. We have the sister of Moses, who is later called Miriam in Exodus 15. We have Pharaoh's daughter, who remains unnamed, but rabbinic literature ends up calling her Batya, the daughter of God, specifically the daughter of Yahweh, actually. The seven daughters, and we also have the seven daughters of the Midianite priest Re'u'el, who we didn't see them covered in that text, but they're there in Exodus 2. And that includes Zipporah, who ends up becoming Moses' wife. So just to set the scene where we are, in Exodus 1, as we heard, we're told that a new king has arisen in Egypt, and he does not know Joseph. The king claims that the Israelite people have multiplied. They've become a threat. They are more numerous, they're more powerful than the Egyptians. And there's a fear that these Israelite people may join in with other people groups and join with them in war against the Egyptians. So the Pharaoh orders that the Israelites should be oppressed. Note that this is the first thing that's mentioned. There's not really a utility here. We need more cities. The purpose is actually to oppress these people with forced labour. It just so happens that that involves building cities. We're also told somehow despite this, the more tasks that they're given, the more that the Israelites multiply. And this is where Shifra and Puah come in. The first individual Hebrews who are identified and named in the book of Exodus are two women, Shifra and Puah. These courageous women are the first to defy the nameless Pharaoh, who has ordered that the midwives kill all male infants. He says, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, she shall live." But Shifra and Puah respect divine authority, not the authority of Pharaoh. The Hebrew says that they fear God, they yarei God, and they do not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, and the Hebrew word here is diber. Why am I talking about Hebrew? Well, I do think it's relevant. I think that these words are alluding, they're going forward in time to Exodus 19 to 24. In biblical Hebrew, in the cultural context of ancient Western Asia, fear is not just an emotion of being scared. It means to be in awe of someone, to honour them, to have reverence or respect towards them. And the words also mentioned in Exodus 19 to 24, when the Israelites come to Sinai and they experience this overwhelming theophany, the thunder, the lightning, the voice of God is so terrifying that they are afraid. And it is through their fear that they've learned to know God, to respect God, and to follow God. And it's also in that context where God delivers the content of the covenant in the form of the Ten Commandments and other laws. Significantly, the word used to describe the Ten Commandments is this same word from the root davar. There are actually 10 words that are given. So I think, in other words, what these words are doing here, these allusions, is it's saying that even before God appears to Moses at the burning bush, where Moses is afraid, even before God appears to the Israelites at Mount Sinai and the people are afraid, it's these midwives who fear God. It is these midwives who know God and fear God and want to seek a covenant with him and not with Pharaoh. So Shiphrah and Puah defies the Pharaoh's command by continuing to let the infant boys live. They also seem to obscure the truth of what is happening to Pharaoh himself, right to his face. They claim that the Hebrew women are actually so vigorous that they give birth before the midwives can even reach them. I haven't given birth, but that sounds like a pretty handy way of doing it. Sounds like a very quick process here. The midwives are not just simply being deceitful here. This is what we might call trickster behaviour, where you have members of a group who are subordinate. They are oppressed. They appear to be powerless, yet they are able to employ their own cleverness, the skills that they have been given, against the will of a more powerful figure. In spurning the Pharaoh's genocidal decree, these women engage in what we might call the first instance of civil disobedience before Moses ever comes onto the scene. And this defiant act of resistance is rewarded by God. God recognizes this action. God deals well with the midwives, and the people multiply further and become strong. The text specifically says it is because the midwives feared God that he gives them houses, batim. Now, the NRSV translates this word houses as families, but we are looking at something far more broad than that. House can also mean dynasty. We have the Beit David, the house of David, the monarchic house. So it's the women who are rewarded with these great dynasties because of their faith, because they feared God. All right, let's look at the mother of Moses, the sister of Moses, and the daughter of Pharaoh. We're told that the Hebrews continue to multiply. They just keep multiplying. And now in response, Pharaoh commands, from the root Sava, all his people to throw every boy that is born to the Hebrews into the Nile. Sorry to keep going on about the Hebrew here, but it is important. The word command here is a powerful word. It's the same word, again, that's used to describe God's covenantal laws, the mitzvah, the commandment. Again, we have this illusion. Pharaoh is trying to act like God, to give commands, and it raises the question, who will the people listen to? Will they listen to Pharaoh, or will they continue to try and listen to God? And just like the midwives, this Levite woman, who we know becomes the mother of Moses, directly disobeys Pharaoh, and she puts herself at great risk to do so. She hides the baby, who will later become Moses, named Moses, and in the famous story, she places him in the papyrus basket in the reeds of the river in order to protect him. Her role now intersects with the sister of Moses, who watches over the basket at a distance. The story is so familiar to us, well, at least it is to me. It's hard to kind of maybe get into the minds of these characters or these historical figures. We can imagine that Miriam must have been absolutely terrified when the Pharaoh's daughter approaches the basket. She sees it in the reeds of the river. We can imagine that Miriam must have been watching and holding her breath as a maid brought the basket to the Pharaoh's daughter and opens up this basket. But remarkably, the baby cries. And this Egyptian woman, perhaps the woman who is the most powerful woman in ancient Western Asia, within North Africa at the time, she hears a baby's cry and she takes pity. She is moved in herself to compassion, even though, or perhaps because, it is a vulnerable Hebrew child. After this remarkable event, Miriam not only approaches the Pharaoh's daughter, but she dares to give her advice. "Shall I go and get a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Once again, for someone like me who's always lived in Australia in relatively comfortable circumstances, it might be a bit easy for us to overlook this is an act of outright insubordination, if not treason, performed in front of a representative of the oppressive government. Remember, this is the Pharaoh's daughter. Yet the Pharaoh's daughter agrees, and the baby's own Hebrew mother is secured to nurse and to raise him. This woman, who will later be called Jochebed, she's no longer even treated as a slave. The text says she's been given wages. This Egyptian woman, the Pharaoh's daughter, has gone against the decree of her own father. She is now collaborating with enemies of the state, two Hebrew women slaves, one whom she is now paying, and she is harbouring a fugitive baby. When the baby is grown, he is now adopted by the Pharaoh's daughter and given an Egyptian name, Moses. Moses is raised by two women, a poor Hebrew slave and an Egyptian princess. We also have the seven daughters of Reuel. We're told Moses grows up. He sees that his people are living under forced labour, and he is clearly distressed. He witnesses a Hebrew slave being beaten by an Egyptian taskmaster, and Moses kills him in response. Moses is again a fugitive, and Pharaoh, who we must remember is Moses' own family at this stage, Pharaoh has decided to kill Moses in response. Moses is able to flee to Midian, where he meets these seven daughters of a local priest. They're being harassed at a local well while they are trying to water their sheep. Moses saves the women, but in response, they help secure the asylum of Moses by praising Moses to their father. And one of the women, Zipporah, marries Moses and will actually later save Moses again from death in a very mysterious event that's narrated later in chapter 4. All right, how do we bring all these things together? I think that the message of the Exodus story is, of course, that our God, the God, is a God who redeems and a God who liberates. And yes, we are told that God liberates us from sin and from death. But God also desires humanity and creation to be free from physical exploitation, from degradation, and from enslavement. It's when our spirit, our hearts, and our bodies are free from other oppressive powers that we can best serve or worship God, the Creator who has given us life. And while the redeeming and the salvific, the saving work of Christ is, of course, unique, the church is the body of Christ, and the individuals that make up the church, the followers of Christ, are called to imitate God's ways. The Exodus story teaches us that God also redeems through the actions of faithful and also ordinary people, and that is regardless, or perhaps it is through, our unique identity and our gender. Moses may be the dominant Israelite personality in the book of Exodus. He does become a distinctly powerful figure and leader of the Israelite people. He's a prophet, he's a priest, he's a lawgiver. We should remember, though, that we are also told he's a very humble man and he has difficulty speaking. So his story is also one of a figure who presents as not having power or being an obvious leader. But in Exodus 1 to 2, it is the seemingly powerless or less powerful women who first discern the will of God, who undermine brutal genocidal practices, who collaborate across cultures, religions, and nation groups, and in doing so, they disrupt oppressive political hierarchies, which in the form of Pharaoh end up looking quite foolish and ineffective. These subversive women who redeemed the Israelite people are godly women, and they are heroes. May we continue to look for them and listen to them in our scriptures, but also in our communities and in the world around us. Thank you.